This is tape number 2, The Zohar of John, Echoes from Eden by Wendell Jones.
Unfortunately, today, the skull has been almost totally obstructed. But if one will go on the top of the wall at the Herod's gate and go to the south, along the top of the wall, to the place where there is a inset in the wall, and go around that inset. There's a school around inside the city. And if you will turn and look across over the Pilgrim's Hotel, where the sun is shining, and it depends on what time of year. But during this time of year, between April and June, between 9 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, as you look straight into the corner of Golgotha, just above the cave of Golgotha, over the top of the hotel, there is two caves, perfectly round, but only at between 9 and 12 o'clock in the morning. Before that, the sun is shining straight in. You don't see it. After that, it's all shadow. You do not see it. Between the hours of 9 and 12, you have the best image. Because the shadows, as they move around this hill, form the most perfect skull. Very few people have ever seen it. The hotel obstructs it from the street. One must get on the wall or get on top of the hotel. The wall is really the best way to see it. You're back from it enough to get the picture of the whole hill. And there, in the side of the hill, is the skull. The full cranium, the cheekbones, the two eye sockets, the nose, down to the upper jaw. The teeth level, a perfect cranium. No imagination. On the left side, around the corner, there is another couple of holes. General Gordon saw those, and with a little imagination, one can imagine that being a skull. On the other side, the only problem is those holes are squinted, and I've never seen a skull squinting. Have you? Skulls don't have eyes to squint. But here is a full-blown skull, cheekbones, nose, cranium, everything, only between the hours of 9 and noon in the morning. After noon, the shadows come over, and it's completely shadowed. It's as though the skull appears and disappears. No guidebook ever written has pointed out this skull. I lived in Jerusalem almost 15 years intimately in this city before I discovered where it is. When I was doing a topographical survey of the bedrock of Jerusalem, I looked up, and there it was before me. I was paralyzed. Josephus describes it, the place of the skull, Golgotha. Here, in the very place where, according to Jewish tradition, Adam was buried, Jesus was crucified and buried. In the 23rd verse of the 19th chapter of John, the soldiers, when they had written over the cross, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. And I want to point out, it was not Aramaic. It was Hebrew. This is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Take it down, said the Judean leaders. But Pilate said, what I have written, I have written. You see, what he wrote there was his protection. And in a legal sense, we must be honest with ourselves. If Jesus claimed to be a king, if he made that claim, which he never did, I want to add, which he never did, seven times he refused the crown. We will deal with that more in depth. We have dealt with that in depth with the previous tape, 8106, in the riddle of the rejected king or the rejected kingdom. Here, if Jesus were guilty of claiming that he was any kind of king, any kind of king, without being duly appointed a king by the Caesar, he was in jeopardy of execution. And Pilate, to secure his own justification for the crucifixion, wrote, this is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, because with that accusation, his crucifixion was justifiable. And Pilate could not be accused. But then when the Jews said, oh, no, 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 we do not want that, when those Judean leaders saw that, they said, no, no, we don't want to be accused of sedition. To say, he said, Pilate scorned them and put them in jeopardy. I gave you your king and you crucified him. The blood is on your hands. What I have written, I have written. The flaming sword of Eden had echoed its way all the way to the top of this hill. And as they prepared to crucify him, the soldiers that were to pound the nails into his hands and feet stripped him naked. Stripped him naked. You say, oh, well, there was a loincloth over him, all the pictures. Yes, I know all the pictures. Now, you've got to see this picture in a moment. The crown of thorns had caused his face to swell till it was beyond the recognition of human form. He had been beaten with the fist of the Roman soldiers. They had struck him with the palms of their hands, karate. They had plucked his beard from his face. He was standing there mutilated, bleeding from the scourging. And then they stripped him naked. Oh, the indignity of exposure to the Jew, even to expose one's arms or his legs, is contrary to the Torah, the Western Wall, are going down the religious sections of Mea Shearim in the Jewish Orthodox quarter of Jerusalem, are hundreds of signs warning the visitors that the Torah strictly prohibits nakedness and exposure of the arms and the legs, and that women must dress modestly. But not only the women, but the men would not wear shorts or wear exposed arms and legs. Here, Jesus is stripped naked in the garden. In the garden, he had just prayed a few hours before, "Mine hour is come. Glorify me with the glory that I had with thee before the world was." Yes, my hour is come. This is what I've been coming for, as he had told Mary 3.5 years before. "My hour is not yet come." Repeatedly, "My hour is not yet come. What I have come to do is not yet." And then he stands before Pilate and says, "For to this end was I born, and for this cause I came into the world. Now, Father, my hour is come." He came to die. I get real irritated at Christmas time every year, which is not even the time which Jesus was born, at the gobbledygook that we hear in our churches about there was no room for him in the inn. The poor little baby Jesus had to be born and laid in a manger. And all the tear jerking and all the boo-hooing that goes on about the poor little baby Jesus having to be laid in a manger. What's the matter with that? "To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world." Where do you think a lamb should be laid other than in a manger, if this was why he was born? And this was the cause for his coming into the world. It would be apropos for him to be born where a lamb, a sacrificial lamb, should be born and laid in a manger. There in the garden, sweat as it were, great drops of blood drip from his brow. "Father, if it be thy will, I pray this cup will pass from me." And again he prayed, "Nevertheless, thy will be done. But let this cup pass from me." He kept praying for this cup, four times, "not this cup." Something about the crucifixion that made him recoil and draw back. Was it the scourging? No. Was it the crown of thorns? No. Was it the nails in his hands and his feet? Was it crucifixion that he drew back from? No. What was he shirking? He was shirking the indignity of hanging in public, totally nude. His groin had no covering except the blood that dried and crusted on it. "Let this cup pass from me." Paul said he endured the cross despising the shame. Well, why in the world was it necessary for him to hang there naked when just a little groin cloth like the artist paint on there would have at least saved him the indignity of exposure of his private members? I hear an echo all the way back to the Garden of Eden. In Genesis, the 3rd chapter, in verses 7 through verses 10, and the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Fig leaves, quickly, quick, an apron, no, not enough. Hide behind the trees, because we hear the voice of the Lord coming. And Adam says, I, Adam, and he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked. I hid myself. And God said, who told thee that thou was naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat? You see, the thing that frightened Adam was, now Adam didn't have clothes on before, but he was clothed in the Shekinah, the glory of God, like the Adam Kadmon from heaven, whose image he was made, clothed in the very glory, the Shekinah of God. But when they sinned, the glory departed, and they were naked. And they knew they were naked, and they tried every way they could to cover up the fact. They were afraid. They drew back. He drew back in the garden like Adam drew back in his garden. He shirked, let this cup pass from me. Let this cup pass from me. The word cup in Hebrew, the same spelling, repunctuated, is the same word for the vagina. It is for this cause in a Jewish wedding that the bride takes a cup and throws it to the ground and crops upon it. She's giving her virginity to this man. Jesus drew back like Adam drew back. Jesus despised the shame as Adam despised the shame. He was naked because in order to clothe us in his righteousness and his justice, he had to reach all the way back into the Garden of Eden and identify himself with Adam. And the echo of his naked body vibrates all the way back behind the trees and behind the apron of fig leaves. I was afraid because I knew that I was naked. Of this experience. Then, in verse 26, Jesus saw his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved, John, of course. And he said unto her, Woman, or mother, and said unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Is this, you remember at the marriage at Cana of Galilee, when the mother of Jesus came and said, they have no wine. She knew who he was. I think she knew why he was. They have no wine. The blood of grapes fermented to sweetness is all gone. And Jesus looked up to his mother and said something that seemed to be rude to our Western ears. He said, Woman, what have I to do with you? My hour is not yet come. And here, his hour was come. And he said to his mother again, Woman, behold thy son, looking at John. And looking at John, he said, Behold thy mother. The word hine in Hebrew means here is. See, here is. And looking to his mother, he said, Woman, here is your son. And looking at John, he said, Here is your mother. The hour is come. And she was called woman, because she was taken out of man. The Hebrew word for man here is ish, and the woman was called isha, because she was taken out of man. So even in the words that he spoke to his mother had its echo all the way back to Eden. And I will put enmity between thee, Satan, and the woman, Isha, who came out of man. It. There's no it in Hebrew. He shall bruise your head. He will crush your head, Satan. But you, Satan, will bruise his heel. And here, mother of Jesus, the daughter of Eve, mother of us all, stood, and her eyes fixed straight forward on the spike that was driven through his foot into his heel and into the cross. Woman, your seed will bruise his head, but he, the serpent, will bruise his heel. And the heel of the seed of the woman was bruised at the crucifixion. An echo all the way back to the Garden of Eden. In verse 25, it says that they stood by the cross. What is the cross? It's a stake of wood. And hanging on this wooden stake, do you know that wooden stake echoed all the way back to Eden? Paul in Galatians quoted from the Torah when he said, "Cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree." Mother Eve reached up in a tree and pulled down by robbery condemnation upon her whole family, world without end. And here, Jesus is nailed back up there where Eve pulled off the fruit. Man's condemnation came into the world by what was pulled off the tree, and man's justification was brought about by the fruit, the seed of the woman who was nailed back on the tree. There was darkness. And in the last hour, verse 28, and after this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished. Why do I laugh? Why do I laugh at such a serious scene? The word accomplished there is the same word in Genesis, the last verse. The closing of the second and beginning of first and beginning of the second chapter, it says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them." And the word accomplished here, Jesus knowing that all things were accomplished, was like the Creator who looked over his creation and it was finished. That the scripture might be fulfilled, he said, I thirst. Having bled most of the living life from his body, and with bleeding comes thirst, dehydration. 6 hours now he had been nailed up there, from the 6th hour to the 9th, and from the 9th to the 12th. That is from 9 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He was put up at the time of the morning oblation. He was taken down after the evening oblation. In the temple, there was a morning and an evening sacrifice. He was nailed up there about the time that the morning lamb was offered. In the temple, there was a morning and an evening sacrifice. He was nailed up there about the time that the morning lamb was offered. And he was taken down at the time of the evening oblation when the evening lamb was slaughtered. What does this have to do? He says, I thirst. And they put hyssop. They took a sponge with vinegar and put it upon hyssop and put it to his mouth. Jesus had received the vinegar. He said, it's finished. Now I want us to see something about this hyssop. Hyssop is a little plant that grows all over Jerusalem and around Israel. If you've ever been to the Western Wall, what used to be the Wailing Wall, and you see there are plants that are growing out of the wall itself with no soil, and you wonder how they survive, but those little plants have been there for centuries, and they keep blooming all summer long. This little plant is called, in Hebrew, the striking plant. It is the hyssop of the Bible. In Egypt, they took the blood and they dipped hyssop into the blood and struck it laterally across the lintel and bilaterally across the doorposts of the houses where they were. It was the striking plant. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest went in to the Holy of Holies with hyssop. He struck it, the blood, across the mercy seat and along the mercy seat before the Ark of the Covenant, or on the Ark of the Covenant. The ashes of the red heifer were made with cedar wood and scarlet, and with hyssop, I shall be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. And here in the picture of the hyssop, the vinegar, that is wine that fails. And the hyssop for atonement. And they put it to his mouth, and when he had received the vinegar, he said, the same thing that the Creator said on the end of the sixth day, it is finished. And that echo goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. In Genesis chapter 2, thus were the heavens and the earth finished, and all the host of them. You see, Jesus was crucified on Friday, on the day of Passover. The Jews could not have done that because they couldn't, the supreme the Sanhedrin court did not meet in the execution of Jesus. It was a motley crowd under the appointment of the Romans. The Sanhedrin could not meet on this day because it was Friday of Passover, the first day of Passover. And the next day would be the Shabbat. And back in the Garden of Eden, when the Almighty God finished the heavens and the earth, on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it because that he had rested from all his work and God, which God created to make. Not and made, but to make. Created to make. You see, creation was only the start of making. And this story that began in Eden has now found itself having echoed through the centuries to another garden just below Golgotha. And the Creator of redemption cried with a loud voice, "It is finished." And he rested on the Sabbath day in a garden tomb. It all started in a garden, and it all ended in a garden. On the back side of the hill, directly behind the skull that we discussed a little while ago, there is a secret opening, only discovered again, or rediscovered. At the end of the last century. And that secret opening at the base of the skull at the base of Golgotha, which is the skull, was the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. And in that tomb, the Creator of our redemption rested from his work of redemption, just as the Creator of the universe had rested from his work of creation. Verse 31 said it was a Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was a high day. It was not only the Sabbath, it was the Feast of Matzo. And they wrapped Jesus and they buried him in the same hill upon which he died. And according to the tradition of the Agudah, in Judaism, Golgotha, the place of the skull, is the place where the first Adam was buried. And it is the place where somewhere there, near the bones of Adam, they laid the body of Jesus. The first time I visited that tomb, the Arab guide said, "Is this the first time you were ever here?" I was standing in a sense of very deep reverence inside that tomb. And it was very hard for my mind to be distracted. I turned and I said, "What is that, sir? What did you ask?" He said, "Have you been here before?" I smiled and I said, "Yes. I was here in 1934. The man looked shocked. He said, "1934? Well, you were just a child." I said, "Yes, I was just a child. But the lady that told me this story brought me here in my experience with the risen Christ. In my soul. And it's so good to be able to come here now with my body also." I looked into the tomb. And in my mind's eye, and through that eye of faith, which we can see the unseen, I looked on that ledge by the head of the tomb, and I saw there is where he laid the napkin. Really the tallit that had been wrapped around his head. And I looked into that cold, empty stone tomb. And I was so thankful that it was empty. You see, the Jews serve a God who cannot be seen and whose name cannot be uttered. And we Christians come and look at an empty tomb. Aren't you glad it's empty? But with my eye of faith, I looked a little closer and I saw lying in that tomb what Peter and John saw, the burial clothes, a linen cocoon of his human form, like a cast around a broken limb, but a form of his entire body laying there with only the face open and altogether empty, undisturbed. A linen cocoon of his human form. And I looked up to the right, to the south side, the foot of that tomb. And then I looked back to the left side, to the north side, the north end, the head of that. And I thought about Peter. And John, when they came into the tomb, and there were there two men clothed in white apparel, one on either end, angels, it said, angels, cherubim, seraphim, whatever, asking sort of a redundant question, why seek ye the living among the dead? He's not here. He is arisen. And I saw those two angelic beings, one on the head and one on the foot of that sepulcher, that had a lid that would lay over the top of it like the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat, upon which there stood two angels, two cherubim, and with two wings they covered their face, and with two wings they covered their body, and with two wings they covered the mercy seat. And it was as though I could hear the cherub singing, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, who was, who is, and evermore shall be." And as I thought of that empty tomb, where every Gentile Christian, ages past and ages to come, had rested his faith in what was experienced here in the resurrection on the first day of the week, at the end of the Sabbath day, Saturday night, as it began to twilight toward the first day of the week, Moshe Shabbat, they found a vacant tomb. What Joseph of Arimathea gave, Jesus had soon returned, only slightly used, because the work that he had come to do was now finished. And the echoes of Eden had resounded. John the mystic, in that other worldliness, has taken us into that transcendental sphere where no other was able to apprehend. Here John treats the passion, the dying of Jesus, in that mystical, transcendental, other world finish, in which, as we stated from the beginning, in the Zohar, it is written, somewhere in each of us there is an Adam. In exile, from the garden in need of restoration. The work of the Kabbalah is to restore man to that primal state. We are the workmen. And we are the laboratory of that workmanship. In the restoration of man to his primal state. If one can but attach the fiber of his own soul to that thread that dangles loosely from the 10 spheres of the Adon Kadmon, he has begun the work of this restoration. Have you been there? Nothing in my experience of many times a year as I go with pastors and church groups and seminary professors and their students and take them through a unique experience in the land of Israel. We never miss this because the greatest treasure to the Christian in the whole land is the empty tomb. But as I said before, you don't have to go there to be there. I was only 4 years old in 1934. When Ms. Will McNeely shared with me the love of Jesus, he died and he was raised again for me. And I went there then. You can too. In that tomb, there is to every man an opening made for all nations, where Israel had that relationship. We didn't. But through that empty tomb, we can go in and we can see those angelic beings like on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant, and we can find refuge there and power in his resurrection. And then we, as Gentiles who had no entrance into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, holy place, not even the outside grounds, we Gentiles can, through the peace of the rent veil, be brought nigh and have entrance boldly into his presence. And in and through that empty tomb, we can know what it means when the psalmist said, "He that dwelleth in the secret place," the secret place, that's where mystics go, "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." mighty. May God lead you into closets and chambers that you never thought of exploring. If you are listening to this tape and don't have the complete set of tapes that go with it, you can get them. Just write us, or write me, Vendell Jones, V-E-N-D-Y-L, Vendell Jones, in care of the Institute of Judaic, J-U-D-A-I-C, Judaic-Christian Research, Box 35, Tyler, Texas, zip 75710. Thank you for your time and letting me share the mystical level of interpretation with you in the echoes of Eden. Shalom.